Time to take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Phil works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison campus. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Tell you what, I know there are lots of people out there with questions about insects, and we've already, every one of our lines is filled at 1-800-642-1234. We have an email question already, email@talk@wpr.org, and we've got several on our Facebook page, including some really cool photographs as well, which Phil's going to identify for us as we go along. So I hope you'll go to the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. If you're near your computer, go there, because there are some pretty cool insects that you're going to see that Phil will identify for us. And also, you know, a week ago, we had some fun with a quiz when wildlife ecologist David Drake was on. So we decided to do another one today. We'll pick three winners at random from all the correct answers. And those people will each receive a copy of Insectopedia by High Raffles. It's not a guide. It's a collection of essays and reflections, one for each letter of the alphabet about the connection between insects and humans. It's pretty cool. You can call in with your answer at 1-800-642-1234, email talk@wpr.org, either phone or email. If you email, please put quiz in the subject line and also include where you live in the message. So an address would be good. And here's the question. The Forest Products Lab in Madison recently assisted a Wisconsin town with a significant termite problem through a unique community-wide eradication effort that worked hard to minimize the use of toxic products. They were able to control the termites successfully. Which Wisconsin town are we talking about? Town that the Forest Products Lab worked with on termites. So again, call in with your answer at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. We'll give you until 12:15 to get your answers in, so you have about 6 minutes here. Again, the Forest Products Lab in Madison recently assisted a Wisconsin town with a significant termite problem. Name the town. Call or email with your answer for your chance to win a copy of Insectopedia. It's a pretty cool book, isn't it, Phil?
Oh, lots of fun. Very, very nice.
Well, we have some photos, I think, that on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. One from Bill wondering, what kind of caterpillar is this? It's a really pretty one.
Yeah, this is the caterpillar of the black swallowtail, it feeds pretty much on parsley and carrot in similar plants in that family. And one of the tricks to these, if you go and touch them, there'll be a little orangish fork-like device that comes out towards the head. And this exudes a chemical that is used for defenses. Now, some people have read into it. It looks like a snake's tongue, and it's used to scare birds. I'm not sure I could draw that line. But very interesting creatures. And I have to say, this has been the best year for swallowtail butterflies that I've seen in quite some time. Lots of the tiger swallowtails, giant swallowtails, black swallowtails. And as I said, and it's only been about the last 3 to 4 weeks that we've seen this big explosion. And so people, I think, should get outside and enjoy that.
Yeah, and take a look at the Facebook page for the photo. Here's one from Michael. I have these all over my squash plants in my community garden plot. Any idea about what they are and what can I do about them? Kind of a, when you blow the picture up here, clicking on it, it's kind of a formidable looking character.
Yeah, I mean, it has this kind of whitish gray cast. This is an immature squash bug. And the very small ones have kind of a light greenish abdomen. And then as they get older, they get grayish. And the full blown adult is more of a medium to dark brown. And this insect has a sucking mouth part. And what's a little unusual about the picture here is usually when you see these immature stages, you see them in clusters, and they're, like, they're ganging up on the plant. And the plant will wilt and yellow. And so they really do have a pretty good impact. The young ones are relatively easy to kill with soapy water. Once you get to the adult stage, they're thick enough skin that I have less faith in it. So we really do try to get people to go after them early. You can see the eggs on the underside of the leaves. You can often destroy those. But again, if you see these little clusters of green bugs, they're going to grow up to be one of these guys or even a little bit bigger than that. And so, as I said, I would suggest trying some soapy water sprays just to get them knocked down.
Get a really nice photograph of that.
Yeah, very much. Digital cameras, as it's evolved now, 50% of what I see are digital images in the lab, and it's just unbelievable. I mean, I could do 20 calendars from the kinds of pictures people send to me. So
wonderful. Andy in Madison has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Andy.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Phil. How's it going?
Good.
So I've got a Dracaena plant. It seems to be infested with scale insects. Do you have any suggestions on how to take care of those?
Well, there's two ways of wrestling with them. The thing about scale is they have life stages that are not available at any one time, and so the strategy is multiple treatments. And the insecticidal soaps they sell work quite well against the immature scales, but you've got to do it on about a two-week interval, 10 days to 2 weeks, with a total of three treatments to kind of catch up to them. So labor-intensive, but works quite well. Another way that is a little less direct is to use systemics. And one of the things you're finding now is in some of the garden stores, they sell these little capsules that have systemic insecticide. Bayer, B-A-Y-E-R, is a company that manufactures it. And you follow directions depending on the size of the plant or the pot, how many to put in. And as you water this, it gets up into the plant through the roots. The systemics are a little slower in working. Once they kick in, though, they will work for an extended period of time. But one of the warnings I always give people is I often find systemics will not eliminate. They will grossly knock down the population, hold it for an extended period of time. But once the product starts to peter out, you're going to have to retreat. The problem has to do with movement of the chemical in the plant, that it's going to the actively growing portions and not so much to the older tissue. And that's where you get survivors with scale. So as I said, if you use any kind of sprays, and there are other kinds of contact sprays, but I think the soaps work as good as anything. So, you know, why not go that direction? Either you do the multiple treatments on a 10-day interval or go towards the systemics.
Okay. And I have a bunch of other kind of Dracaena plants. Do I have to worry about them going to them at all? Are they really transiented, or are they pretty much stuck on one plant?
Well, no, the immature stages are legged and can crawl, and so you would probably want to isolate this plant. And the other thing is, be a little careful when you're watering, because you can honestly have them hitchhike on your watering can. So the advice would be to treat the non-infested plants first, and then the last plant you water is the one that's infested.
Okay.
Cool. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Andy. Marwin in Mineral Point, on to you now. Hi.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have two quick questions. One is that I have been doing some landscaping and digging some holes, planting some stuff, and on occasion I've run into small, what I guess I would call nests, but there's nothing physical about it. They're just a gathering of these insects. And they're about ant size, but they're definitely not ants. They don't have that configuration, but they're ant size, and they have kind of elongated wings on their back, of course. And I've seen them in a couple different places. They're not close to wood. They're just out in the open in the dirt. Could they be embryonic cluster flies?
No, embryonic cluster flies are maggots.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I'm still not sure they're not ants. I mean, the other thing that I see in clusters that are winged are something that we call bark lice or sosids. But typically those are found on the trunk of a tree, and you'll see a cluster, 4 or 5 inches in diameter of all these little wing things kind of wriggling around. The phenomena with ants and swarming is in usually late afternoons, you will get clusters of wing forms kind of congregating in one site. And then as you watch them, they tend to disperse. You can see them flying up without seeing it, ants definitely do have a constriction between their thorax and their abdomen.
Yeah.
If this is more of a solid body critter, it definitely couldn't be an ant. But like I said, the only other thing I could think of that's clustered like that would probably be these bark lice.
Okay. They don't seem to fly. They seem to stay underground. I've discovered them as I've been digging in the.
Well, but see that's what ant swarms will do, is that there's certain triggers that cause them to go. So it's like they're staging, and so you see this sometimes. When you have a rotten log, you open it up, and there's regular ants, and then there's all these winged ones around there, and they'll stay in there. You can find the wing forms for a couple months in the colony, but then all of a sudden, when the right conditions, and for certain ants, it's different times of the year, then you get this swarming phenomena where all of a sudden they're allowed to leave.
Okay, well, there's no surface indication that they're there. I just happened to discover them as I dig.
Well, not all ants, have visible nests. There is a common one that we call the citronella or yellow ant, and it's kind of funny because the wing forms are more brown, and the workers tend to be more yellowish. And I never see any above-ground evidence, but I often see those when I'm digging, especially in more moist soil. seems to be where they're often clustered.
Well, that, I don't have moist soil. I have pretty pretty hard soil, St. Peter sandberg or sandstone, but it's not nutritious soil. I have to always augment it. But I have one quick question. Are cluster flies out and about?
Smidgen early, but it's not going to be long. I usually think of the 1st of September as potentially the time. You know, and it's going to be an interesting one to watch. My guess is in parts of the southern part of the state that have been on the dry side, since cluster flies breed on earthworms, that they're probably not going to be in high numbers this year. The northern part of the state, where things have been quite a bit lusher, it's the exact opposite. And so, you know, I usually tell people, if you've had history of cluster fly problems, somewhere between the 1st to 15th of September is when you'd want to treat the outside of the structure.
You know, and we had, and thanks a lot for calling, Marvin. Appreciate your call. We did have a Facebook comment from Lucy on that, that she took your advice last year regarding cluster fly control and in their cabin, and it worked great. And she passed the same information on to her brother-in-law or brother, and it worked great as well.
Well, you know, the biggest problem we've always had historically with cluster flies is people recognizing these are not house flies, that it's a different animal, has a different biology, and it is quite predictable. So, yeah, it's been one of these things. And, you know, sometimes, even though we have opinions or scientific thoughts of where this will go, sometimes, more than once, I've been wrong in my predictions. But said this going, I would go back to, if you've had a history of cluster flies, they're often there 4 out of 5 years. And so I think it's very justifiable to do this preventative kind of spray.
And Lucy, while I'm on it, she also had a question about wasps or hornets. They build nests in the peak of the house outside and in the garage or outside the garage. Is there anything we can put up there to prevent that, or do we just have to keep knocking the nest down?
Well, you know, one of the things, especially like on two stories, I often suggest to people, why bother? I mean, the problem is when you disturb the nest is when you're most likely to get stung. And so if they're close to where people can bump into, you have to deal with them. They're really hard to discourage. You know, I have seen some cases where they put a fine netting up there and they really can't, you know, get contact with the surface. You know, but that's hard to work with. And, you know, it
you don't
attracts.
Want to be climbing around up there.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, the other side of it is that all of these species, for the most part, tend to start the colonies in early June. And so often if you treat and kill the queens, then you win. Although the interesting thing, this European paper wasp, Polistes dominulus, that has moved in the state the last 4 or 5 years, seems to nest awful late in the season. I mean, I've seen them starting established nests even into August. And so, you know, for those, you kind of have to react to. But again, I usually assess where the nest is. If there's children or people or pet potential contact, we have to deal with it. But if it's in places, you know, high up and whatnot, I think they're better to be left alone. Because you can definitely argue most of these species are predators on caterpillars and other things that sometimes are garden pests. And so, you know, they do have their place.
Yeah, absolutely. Our phones have been full the whole time, and so people have not been able to phone in with an answer to the question to try and win a copy of Insectopedia. So we're going to give you until 11:25, let's say. And I would advise you to probably email. If you can email, you can try to call, but email us. Put quiz in the box, the subject line. Include where you live in the message. And the question again was, the Forest Products Lab in Madison recently assisted a Wisconsin town with a significant termite problem. What Wisconsin town was it? And for three people, you'll be getting a copy of Insectopedia by High Raffles. Fun book. So, you got another 5 minutes. Let's go to Tom in South Beloit, Illinois. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, good morning to both of you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, I wanted to talk about Japanese beetles. I know that's one of your favorite subjects. I've been catching them in the bags for a number of years now, even though I've heard recommended you're not supposed to do that. But over the years, I think I've managed to reduce the population on my acreage so much that before we'd have to go out and hand pick them off the basil and stuff like that. And this year, there was only a couple times when we had to even do that. But I still catch bags full every day. But the one thing that's happened this year that hadn't happened before, and I'm not sure what could be doing it, But one of them, I have three different bags hung up at different places across my field. And the northernmost one that's along the edge of the woods, every couple of days, it'll be ripped open. The plastic bag will actually be ripped open. And I'm wondering if you'd had any ideas if that could be a skunk that was jumping up in the air. Or if
yeah, I think
yeah.
Skunk or raccoon has taken advantage of that good protein source, I'm sure.
Okay.
Now, here's the science behind it. And again, the one blessing we have is that the people out east have dealt with this problem for decades. And the research shows us that you only catch 3 out of 4 beetles that you attract to your property. And the 25% that remain will attack your plants. And so in many cases, that causes more problems than if you have no traps at all. Now, we've talked before on the show, if you do have a big enough property that you can move the beetle traps a good distance away, and I'm talking 75 to 100 yards, then I can see that you lessen some of the pressure. Now, as far as affecting overall population breeding, I don't think they have any effect. The only time we've seen any successful trapping out of Japanese beetles have been in Colorado in some of the eastern cities that are kind of out in the plains where, yeah, you know, it's too dry for them to breed out in the desert. The only place they're breeding is in the irrigated areas in these small towns. And if they put, and we're talking hundreds of traps up, they found that they could trap them out. So there are some circumstances, but I think the problem in our area is we're too lush, they're too widespread. Now, the other side of the phenomena, and I keep saying this, and this is hopeful for those of you that are just getting into bad Japanese beetle problems, is that in many places we have seen populations lessen considerably. And it ebbs and flows a little bit, but again, I've had them for 12 years on the west side of Madison. They're nowhere near the kind of problem we have, even though I live within a block of a golf course, and you know there's still plenty of Japanese beetles to go around, but their populations have dropped, I'd say 70 to 80% in my yard. But I've had it for long term. Statewide, the discussion has been there's a lot of people that are just getting into them for the first time. And even in the Madison area, you know, Oregon and Stoughton, I mean, there's places that they haven't seen them before. And it's fun to talk to people because, you know, somebody will say, you know, I got them just crazy. I know somebody 2 miles down the road, they don't know what I'm talking about. And you kind of say, give it time.
Yeah.
Because what you tend to see is these populations tend to slowly grow and spread out.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Thanks for listening in. Again, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Email us, talk@wpr.org, or a post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and we'll get you on, or we'll do our best to get you on. Let's go to Bill in Dancy, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill.
Hello there. I thank you for taking my call. I'm a believer in recycling building materials, so I've torn down quite a few homes, and I got a hold of an old home, and I use materials to build a fairly nice home. But one problem I do have with doing that is I've got power post beetles, mm-hmm, and I'm wondering what I can treat that with. I've heard it talked about before on your show, but I never get a chance to write it down.
Sure.
And also how you would treat it with that material that you'd
Okay, the product is sodium octaborate, which is basically a form of boric acid. The two most common product names you will see it sold under, one is Timbor, T-I-M-B-O-R, which is a powdered form. The other one is Boracare, B-O-R-A-C-A-R-E, which is a liquid form in a glycol base, but in both cases you mix it with water and you spray it lightly, or could paint it on the wood. But in order for this to work, the wood has to be unfinished because it has to soak in. And so if there's any kind of paint or varnish in the like, it won't penetrate. But the idea is that it penetrates into the wood. It leaves this octaborate behind. And boric acid is a stomach poison. And so when the beetles come up to feed to the surface, they ingest it and die. And, you know, so it's a relatively non-toxic product to work with. And it honestly is a semi-permanent treatment unless the wood is exposed to outside moisture, because you can throw enough water at it, you will leach it out. But of course, in those situations, you can treat and then seal it in with whatever. And so It is a pretty easy product to use, and you know, depending on the surface area you need to treat, you know, you can figure how much product you need. What you find, the Boracare is sold in a gallon. It's relatively expensive. It goes quite far. I've seen the Timbor even sold in as small quantities as a half pound. And if you can't find it locally, easy to get on the internet.
Okay. Well, my logs that I want to treat are stained. Now, that wouldn't be the same as the paint to fend off.
Well, but it depends on how, if the stain's got a sealant in it. As I said, the whole idea here is that it has to be able to diffuse into it. And so if there's something that prevents the penetration of the water, then it's going to be problematic. Now, the other side with powder post beetles, though, is I often find is a question, is it old activity that's died out, or are they active now?
Yeah, no, they're still active.
Okay.
It's dusty there.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for your
time. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Sarah in Brownsville, Minnesota is wondering, is there a CD for night insect calls? I'm interested in identifying the chorus of calls we have around our property. We live on the edge of a wooded area with a large planted prairie meadow, and I think this year is the loudest for insect calls. I'm also hearing more cicadas this year.
Well, you know, the book that I would suggest, because it's got a CD, so it's a combination. If I remember right, the title is Songs of Insects. And it was put out a couple years ago, and it's a combination. It has a CD in the back that has all the calls, but it has exquisite pictures of the insects that cause them and range distribution maps and all this other stuff. So it's a good combination. You can both hear and then see the picture of what it looks like, or vice versa. If you find a critter, you can compare it and see if it's found in your area. And it's very reasonably priced, I think under $25, maybe even under $20 for the book. So unfortunately, I don't remember the author on the top. But Songs of Insects is the title that's sticking in my head.
Alice in Ferryville, we're on to you now. Hi, Alice.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Oh, lots of millipedes.
Oh.
It seems like, why, it must be at least 6 weeks, and every morning they go out the door and they're just crawling all over and up the side of the house, and I don't know anything about them or why there's so many.
Been getting lots of calls since the 1st of July, and many people in the same setting that you have. It's just been a continual problem, and it's a number of different species. I mean, it's really interesting to watch. So it's a general phenomenon, not any given species. In what millipedes do, and I honestly will tell you, I'm not so sure we understand all the dynamics here, but millipedes live in the soil. They are found where there is rich organic matter, and they should stay in the soil. But at certain times, sometimes related to late summer, sometimes people think related to drought, sometimes I'm not so sure we come up with a reason, they go through this wanderlust phase, and they start dispersing. And they're doing most of this at night. And when the sun comes up, they will tend to accumulate where it's damp, dark, and cool. So cement slabs, driveways, foundations of houses. Sometimes they even work up in the house and fall in, and then they die because it's too dry. There's nothing to eat. I mean, that's not the environment that they are looking for, but they don't know any better. And the numbers can be absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, I have had pictures people sent me this year of them 5 inches deep every morning on their front stoop, and no matter what you do. And, you know, Stan Temple, I think Stan has been on the show before, has shared with me. We were talking about how far they can come away, and I said, well, I know they can come from at least 100 yards away. So he did an experiment that he figures that they can go 5 yards in about a minute. So he's figuring that it doesn't take more than about 20 minutes for them to go 100 yards. And so this dispersal is, and that's the problem with them. And so, you know, I tease people that if you don't want millipedes, well, if you make a half-mile sandbox around your house, you would not have the conditions that would push them. But if you've got rich areas with prairie grass and long grass, or even in the woods with all the leaf litter, and I think part of the artifact of this year is the lushness of last year, the high moisture levels we had, which are great for growing our plants, but that probably was good for the millipedes, and it's caused their populations to build, and now they're moving out. And, you know, normally I'd tell people 2 to 3 weeks and life would get better, but the way this is going, I'm not so sure we're going to see relief until the frost comes.
Oh, there you go. Thank you very much for calling, Alice. Appreciate your call. Well, we've closed the quiz, and we have picked three winners from among those who had the correct answer. And the question, again, was the Forest Products Lab in Madison recently assisted a Wisconsin town with a significant termite problem. What Wisconsin town was it? I will endeavor to give you the answer right now. It's Endeavor, Wisconsin. And they did a lot of, they did not want to spend, or they couldn't spend a lot of money. It says, this is a small town, 450 people. well, with a significant problem.
And the difference is that if you were to do traditional treatments, you can protect individual houses, but those kind of treatments that are pouring chemicals around the foundation don't kill the termites as much as repel them. Whereas the strategy, and this has really been a long-standing, the original work was started with Dow Chemical when they came out with their baiting. They stopped baiting, and then Forest Products took an interest. And what we were always intrigued with is that the potential of eradication, that you would wipe them out, which would be just a neat way of dealing with it. And so they played around with a combination of baits. They've also had some dusting techniques where they put the toxicant on caught termites and release them. And boy, the last 18 months or so, there have been no termites they can find. And so it suggests that they may have eradicated them. And the neat thing about the baits and the dusts is they're far less toxic products. You don't use as much. A little bit of labor-intensive, but Dr. Green and Rachel Arangel, who are the people over at Forest Products that have been working on this project for a number of years, have got just a real neat story to tell. And again, Endeavor didn't have a lot of resources to deal with this, but as they said, it was an ideal situation because termites are so isolated in Wisconsin. We've got these little pockets, and when you've got a pocket, you can wipe it out and nobody else is coming, so that's a good sign.
That's a very, very good sign. And we have the quiz winners. And the quiz winners are Joan in Madison, Kathy in Oregon, and Greg in Luxembourg. And you will all three of you will receive your own copy of Insectopedia by High Raffles, Not a Guide, collection of essays and reflections, one for each letter of the alphabet about the connections between insects and humans. And it's a neat book, a really neat book.
Well, insects are neat in general, so, you know, any book about them. But this one is a real interesting treatise, and as they said, little essays and whatnot, and I think people will maybe look at insects in a new light.
Roger in Lake Zurich, Illinois, on to you now. Hi, Roger.
Good morning. Great show.
Thank you.
I have a comment. We do have a lot of swallow-tailed butterflies in our area here this year. Interesting. You said you're seeing a lot of my. I don't recall ever seeing so many, and it's wonderful that we have so many. Also, our Japanese beetle populations are very small this year. And then the question I had was on ambush bugs. I'm really fascinated by them. Got some in my yard. I'm just wondering if they're really much of a threat to bees. Also, I've heard that they can bite people. And I'm wondering how you can identify a male from a female. And I've seen them where they're stacked or piggybacked three bugs high.
Okay, well, that may be a way of identifying. I don't know of any morphological characters, but I haven't studied ambush bugs that carefully. They're generalists. And so it is true that, you know, they would feed on a honeybee as likely as they would a syrphid fly or a butterfly. But that really doesn't have a major impact on bee populations. And you do have to be careful in handling them because, like a lot of the predaceous bugs, they have the capacity to give you a bite that you will remember. And I mean, there's nothing dangerous about it, but localized, the pain and swelling can be enough that you'll be careful the next time. But you have to basically handle them. I mean, they're not aggressive at all. They have these very pronounced forelegs. I always tease my students that it's kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, that's what they remind you of. And, of course, that's what they use to grasp their prey. And the more common ambush bugs are yellowish with some black markings, and you'll often find them in goldenrod and other yellow flowers where they are blended in so well. And as the name implies, they just sit waiting for their prey to come in. So they're neat, basically a late summer critter, just the way their life cycle works. You don't see the nymphs and stuff earlier, but at this time of the year, if I had to go look for them, I would look for a patch of goldenrod or other yellow flowers and then peek in there. And they're about half inch long or so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been taking super macro photos of them. I have them on my Flickr site, and I'm going to be sending an email to Judith of my Flickr site. I have videos of them and all kinds of things, but I'm very fascinated by them. And mine are more or less the ones you discussed the last section of our talk, the ones you said that go on to goldenrod flowers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that I have mostly here. But there is one that's predominantly green, and I'm thinking, and it's larger. I'm thinking that might be the female. And then the males have that black cape, and they're smaller.
Yeah, I mean, the size would fit, but I'm not sure on the color. You know, one of the places you might go is Bug Guide and go under ambush bugs. Because that's a site, if you don't know what you're looking for, there's just so much stuff there, it's overwhelming. But if you know what you look for, they will have pictures of all kinds of ambush bugs. You know, my guess is for a lot of insects, if we count the number of abdominal segments, that's how we can tell them apart. You know, males might have one more or whatnot, or there might be a special marking. But you may also have more than one species. As I said, I just haven't worked with them enough to know exactly how many species we have here. But Bug Guide would clean that up pretty quick if you needed to get some more information, I think.
I've been to a lot of sites on the Internet, and there isn't much information on ambush bugs. But I do notice the larger one is the one that they'll piggyback onto.
Yeah. That would definitely suggest, because usually you find the males on top, and again, it isn't unusual the insects to have more than one male courting a female. So
there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. But Bug, what's it again? Bug Guide?
Bug Guide is the internet site, and it's a site where people post pictures, get them identified, and then they put it into a database. And so, as I said, it's just absolutely amazing the number of pictures. And I'll be honest, I use Bug Guide sometimes when I'm looking for certain things. I have a general inkling of what it is. But for people said, I've got this little black bug in my hand, I would not suggest they go there, because just, as I said, hundreds of thousands of pictures, and trying to go through all of them would drive you crazy.
Seth and Rice Lake, we're on to you now. Hi, Seth.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just got a question on earwigs. I've been up in Rice Lake here for 11 years now, and I've never seen one before. I used to live in Milton by Janesville, and when I was little, and we used to see them all the time, you know, under the rocks where they, you know, live in that. And then every once in a while, you'd see them on the wall in the house at night. And I'd never seen one up north in Rice Lake. And then the other day, about a week ago, I was working on my house, and I noticed them crawling across the front. So I called the kids over because they've never seen one before, and showed them that, and they went back in the backyard. We're playing the sandbox, and 10 minutes later, they yelled at me to come back there, and they had found three of them in the sandbox. So my question really is just, are they migrating? Have you heard anything?
Yes. Oh, no, definitely. You know, I always tell this story. When I first started as an entomologist, the only place we had earwigs are along the lakeshore in Milwaukee. And being such a wise scientist, I always said, well, that was the lake effect. It was just mild enough it took them about 4 years to get to Madison. And, you know, I've been hearing more comments of them up in Ashland in the northern part of the state, but that's only been in the last 3 or 4 years. And so, yeah, they're expanding their range. And I just always say it takes a long time for an earwig to walk from Madison to Ashland. So that's why it's been 20 years. But, I get more calls up that way. And the interesting thing down here, and this is a pattern I see with so many invasive things, is earwigs are not near as bad as they were 20 years ago when they were first getting cooking in the Madison area.
Yeah. So you got a little to look forward to there, Seth, a few years of that. Your kids will be through college, and by that time, the earwigs should be...
It was a very light year in Madison this year. I saw a handful of them, but, you know, when in a bad year, you find a handful every morning under every one of your flower pots, so...
Thanks again for calling. Dan in Fond du Lac, turning to you now. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife and I were curious about some bugs we saw in our backyard. And actually, they weren't bugs. They used to be bugs. They're just empty shells of bugs that they're about the size of a bumblebee or so. And at one point, we saw something coming out of them. And I don't know if it's kind of something morphing out of there or if it's a parasite that eats the bug.
Yeah, my first guess is they're cicadas, and it's the nymphal stage that comes out, and it usually attaches itself to a rock or to a tree trunk or something.
Side of a house.
And then they split right down the middle, and then the insect comes out, and that's now the adult with wings. You know, it takes them a little bit of time to get everything hardened and working right, and then they fly off, and they leave this old shell behind. And
What it was then.
Yeah, and there's different species. I mean, we have at least 5 different species of cicada in the state, and some smaller. I mean, the most common one is the dog day cicada, which is the one that's been making most of the noise down here for about 5 weeks or so, and the like. But there are other species that we have had documented. So
there you go. Thank you for calling. An email from Debbie. Is there any way of killing wolf spiders that live in the septic system? They come up through the bath drain, and I hate them. I shudder thinking of them.
Oh, boy. They're other than trapping, you know, and I'm not so sure. You know, wolf spiders are nighttime hunters, so they're crawling around all the time at night, and then they're looking for sheltered places to spend the day. And if they crawl into something, they will. But, you know, big and ugly, but the good news is that they're really harmless. If you picked one up, you have a chance of getting bitten. I have yet to see anybody catch one and get bit. I mean, usually people are a little more careful, so it really is not very likely to have happened. But other than putting a glue board or something else out that when they walk on, they get caught, I'm really not sure how to deal with it.
Email from Aaron. I'm wondering what would cause butterflies to be attracted to a particular person. My wife has been swarmed by butterflies on a couple of separate occasions. They would swarm around her, try to land on her, and pursue her when she tried to get away. We're just curious as to what could be attracting the butterflies. Could be color of her clothing?
Could be color. They have a different visual spectrum than we do. And so sometimes what appears as one color to us appears a different one to them. You know, the question would come up if there's some kind of perfumes that have nectar-like smells might also be somewhat attractive. So those would be my two guesses, but that's what I tell you is I think they're guesses.
And an email from Tad. We had a huge hatch of dragonflies the other day, very large ones. As we walked through the grass, we would kick up smaller bugs that would have the dragonflies swooping right next to us. The next day, they were all gone. Can we expect another hatch?
Well, you know, one of the phenomena people watch sometimes is you get these little swarms of dragonflies. And what's interesting is it's been documented there's often more than one species in these. And I guess is they're just out hunting. And if there's a lot of good food around, they'll hang. But if not, it's not that unusual to see them move. We do have a couple species that migrate. And it's getting to be, you know, insects use these shortened day lengths just like plants to know something's happening. So that could possibly be. So I just wonder if you were lucky enough to have one of those swarms show up and try to get something to eat, but the chance of seeing it come back is probably pretty small. They're not a real common phenomena to see a swarm. Individual ones, yes. Get around a pond, see a few, yes, but to see these groups of them is not that common.
And a Facebook question from Nick. A couple of weeks ago, I noticed a dead bumblebee in the gravel next to the building. The next day I saw it was still there, but partially covered with small pieces of sand and gravel. As I looked closer, there were small ants slowly covering it up. By the next day, it was completely buried. Now, a couple of weeks later, the bee has been uncovered. I'm guessing from the elements. Do you have an idea why the ants were burying the dead bumblebee?
Boy, unless the ant nest was right underneath or close by, you wouldn't think, you know, there's no advantage. They don't cache food like, you know, some mammals and whatnot. So as I said, my only guess is that there was a ant colony close to being underneath that, and they were pulling it down to feed. And, you know, part of so much of what the insect outside skin and cuticle is non-digestible. And so after they get what they need, I could see where they could care less. In fact, they would prefer to get rid of it. In fact, that's how I can tell when I've got carpenter ants or pavement ants in houses, is that when I see the debris, I always have little insect bits mixed with it because it's part of this stuff they can't digest. And it's like their garbage pile. They just kick this stuff out.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects with Phil Pelletieri today. Had a Facebook question for you, Phil, from Warren. What's the best time to treat for lawn grubs? Are they foraging in the turf right now, or should I wait until later in September? Do I need to time it before a rainstorm? I have an acre lot, and it's impossible to get the entire lot well-watered in 24 hours, as the label for triclosporin granules recommends.
Okay, yeah. Well, the product you picked is a good choice because it is what we call a rescue treatment. The question is what species of grubs? If it is our traditional white grubs, now would be a fine time to treat. If it was Japanese beetle grubs, I'd say this is not the time to treat because honestly, the eggs are just being laid and they're just hatching. And so it's really something that would be put on much later in September into October if you were going to need to put it on. And the biggest problem with this product is just that, is getting it moved. You know, some of the older diazinon treatments that were done, the success rate was like 50%, and it had an awful lot to do with if you allowed the product to dry when you sprayed it as a liquid, you couldn't move it. And so, yes, we often tease that you put it on during a rainstorm, but the whole thought here is you've got to get enough water on right away so the product doesn't get tied up but moves down where it will do some good. And, you know, I usually in the late summer and fall is when we get a lot of the skunk and raccoon damage. That's how people often are aware that they have big grub numbers. You can get a pretty good idea, though, if you go out there with a knife and cut back the soil. You know, one would anticipate you need at least 3 or 4 grubs per square foot before you get enough densities that you would expect lawn damage. Densities underneath that don't warrant treatment, and we all have some grubs. But when they do get up above those higher numbers, if things get going, and it's interesting, you know, what people often are not aware, they have the grub problem until, you know, the lawn goes drought because it's not raining. Then it starts to rain and things green up, but the grub damaged areas don't because they've eaten the roots off. And that's often the signal that, and as we talked about, the skunk and raccoons tearing things apart. And you never see skunks digging unless there's something to eat. So,
do moles also?
Moles will feed on grubs, but I think the things that people sometimes are misled in is they're said, well, you treat your lawn, get rid of the grubs, and you'll have no moles, but moles eat earthworms. And so oftentimes I find people are grossly disappointed because they've spent all this money to kill the grubs. The moles haven't went away. And so, as I said, I think you have to sit back and see. And I would think more often than not, it's earthworm related than it is grub.
Susan in Waupaca, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have some worms on the underside of, or I guess they're caterpillars, on the underside of my dogwood red twig dogwood leaves. They're dark green or black on the top and yellow on the bottom, and they're all in little spirals, and they have decimated the leaves on the plant. Do you know what they are? And also, when should I don't ever notice eggs. All of a sudden, I notice my leaves are disappearing.
Yeah. Well, the good news, first of all, is that, you know, this late in the season, this kind of feeding is cosmetic, so it's not going to hurt the bush.
Good.
The critter is called a dogwood sawfly, and so it's not a sawfly, S-A-W-F-L-Y. So it grows up to be something that's really a primitive wasp rather than a moth or a butterfly. They always feed in groups. They're selective on dogwood. That's why you don't see on anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Relatively easy to control. Somehow, I guess I would say, you know, if your experience is you see them at the end of August, I would consider going around the 15th of August out there and treat in insecticidal soap as many landscape sprays. They're not hard to kill. The question is to get them early enough, and they're predictable. I always think of them as a relatively mid to late summer pest. And, you know, I've been seeing samples for about the last week or so, and usually people catch them when they're pretty much close to being done feeding. But you just walk it forward 2 weeks earlier, and I think you'd be there right at the right time.
Okay. Are they more prolific this summer than normal?
No, I mean, at least from what I've seen so far, I've seen probably about four or five samples in the lab from around the state. So I haven't had any indication that they're crazy this year. On the other side, there are some years I never see samples. And so said I was not surprised that you mentioned it. And your description is classic, the yellow tummies on them and then the kind of blackish, almost plating that they have on their body.
Spiraled. All right, I used an insecticide. It did some good, but they're still here. So you suggest insecticidal soap.
Well, the soap's, you know, a less toxic option. I mean, things like 7-malathion, permethrin. Like I said, I've never considered sawflies difficult to kill.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yep.
I'll try that next year.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Georgia in Green Bay, on to you now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about what I think is an anthill. I have a lot of native grasses planted in my yard, and I noticed one day that all of the stems were laying on the ground. And when I looked at it closely, it looked like there was a giant, it almost looked like an igloo in the middle, like a hornet's nest, but there were ants crawling all around, and it is huge.
Yeah, those are, we call
what
them field ants, in the genus is Formica, and the colonies live up to 10 to 12 years, and they're very common in open ground, and at times they will disturb some of the plants around them, both because they bury the plants, they kick up so much soil when they're making their cavities, but also they don't like their nest to be shaded, and they have the capacity to inject formic acid into the roots of the plant. That's how they kill it. And that's where the name of Formica.
How do I get rid of those?
Okay, so the secret here is that there is a queen that could be 2 or 3 feet deep in the ground.
Oh.
And so anything you do to treat the surface of the nest is going to be very disappointing. What we suggest for this kind of thing is to, we have to make some channels as deep in the ground as we can. So I've used, you know, an old crowbar or an old broom handle and push it in. And make 3 or 4 channels, as I said, 18 inches, 2 feet, as deep as you can get them within reason. Then you mix up whatever ant control product you want. Usually I mix it in a bucket, and then I pour it down those channels, so I'm getting extremely deep. And that,
what do you suggest to use?
Any ant spray, to be honest, or, you know, products like 7-malathion, permethrin, are all very effective. It's all about getting it deep enough. So most of the garden insecticides you have would be suitable. The only ones that wouldn't be is some of the bacterial insecticides that are selective on caterpillars. So I often pick 7 because it's a very good ant-killing product and it's very readily available. In this case, I would prefer a liquid form because you're mixing it. And the other thing we often talk about is after doing the treatment, take the untreated soil and pull it over the top. So we're capping it with untreated, that the pesticide is only down where the ants are. In 7 degrades relatively quickly. So it is effective, but yet it's not a long-term thing. But it's all about getting it deep enough. The other side of it, though, is in prairies, these ants are important ecologically because they literally help recycle nutrients and the like. And so they are a normal part of a landscape in grassy areas.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have Dan in Partyville up next. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I've got a question. We've always had crickets around, but it seems like we have an inordinate amount of them this year. Was it a good season for a good spring for them, or is it a kind of a cyclical thing?
Well, it is cyclical. I've never been able to put my finger on what makes good and bad cricket years. In general, crickets and grasshoppers seem to prefer drier springs because their eggs and little babies don't get washed out. So I've seen very wet springs tend to be pretty tough on him. But other than that, as I said, I'm sure the heat this year got everything going pretty good, got things developing quicker. So that might be part of it. But as I said, other than knowing that people that usually have a lot of crickets have large areas of grassy areas and in similar habitats close by. So it's usually more of a semi-rural problem than it would be in the city where we just have these landscape lawns that are really ecological deserts.
I have grass and prairie grasses and a prairie garden out there, and it just seems they're just all over. I used to see them at night last year, but this year they're during the day, morning. It doesn't matter; they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, cool.
Yeah. Well, there are times again the numbers can be staggering. Might be the best way of putting it. And crickets really do very little damage. There's been a couple cases of I've seen crickets indoors chewing on things you'd rather they didn't. But then we go back to like so much of this stuff that comes in the house is that if you tighten things up and keep them on the outside, that shouldn't be a problem. But unfortunately, I don't think you're going to see of anything. I'd expect the numbers as these crickets mature to continue to stay pretty heavy until we get probably 2 or 3 significant frosts.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Dan, for calling. And Mark in Columbus, on to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I'm wondering if you can help me out, with an insect ID from a week or two ago. I was in northern Wisconsin on a lake, but the insect came out of we found it on the ground in the grass. It was about the size of a damselfly, 2 sets of wings like that, and a damselfly type of a head. But the tail section was long and skinny, almost like a scorpion stinger. It curled up like that. Any idea what that might have been? It was black.
There are some interesting parasitic wasps that one, it just might be. And a lot of times when you've got long abdomens like this, these are wasps that go after grubs in the ground and so they need something to be able to get that deep enough to go after it. So
okay.
There's a pelicynid wasp is one possibility. It could be something else, but that would be one of the things I would look at.
Okay.
The other thing is, aphid lions or ant lions, have a similar type of body structure and whatnot, but they're not very common in the state. As I said, I wonder if it's one of these wasps, and the pelicynid is one family, but we've got a couple other ones that could be too.
All right.
Now, would my buddy's boy have picked it up and been stung by it?
He
and tossed it, but I didn't know if he didn't have a real reaction to it.
Well, no. Sometimes the insects have little spines on their legs, and of course, when they scratch it across you, people think they're getting ready to bite. And some things do have the jaws capable of giving you a little nip, but these kind of parasitic wasps, they're not stingers. They are egg-laying devices. That's the natural reason for having these things, and that some of them have evolved into stingers for defensive purposes. And of course, when a wasp does that, it loses its reproductive rights because it's no longer an egg-laying thing. So those are basically colony forms of wasps and bees, whereas these, quote, parasitic ones, even though we call them wasps, they are stingless wasps.
And Judith is going to post a pelicynid photo up on our Facebook page so people can see that. And so just go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And you mentioned the songs of insects, and I should have remembered the author because I had one of the authors on the show, Lang Elliott.
Ah, yes.
And Will Hershberger. In fact, I had them both on the show to talk about their book when it came out. And we posted, Judith, again, in her efficient way, has posted a link to that particular book. The song, and that's for the person who wanted
a CD.
CD of the insect sounds. This has the CD, but it also has, as you say, just wonderful photography.
Right.
They had some great stories to tell about how they collected some of the photos. I remember there was an insect that they had hunted around and around, and they knew where it should be. Should be out, you know, in the woods in this particular places, and they came back to the, they didn't find one, and they came back to the parking lot, and there was a pop machine, and there were about 10 of them right on the pop machine.
That's exactly what you'd expect. I love it.
So they were able to get some really, really great pictures. I don't know if they shoot them off the pop machine and then took the pictures or what they did. Oh, man. Phil Pelletieri, University of Wisconsin Extension Entomologist. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. So you stay with us. Post your question on the Facebook page here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. Lots of callers online at 800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Post a question or even a photo. And we have another photo here that looks to me like a mantis, huh?
Yeah, it's, the interesting thing about mantids, they're not native to the state. People have been able to buy these egg cases we call Oetheca and raise them. But, you know, in my youth, they always froze out. They never could survive. But we've talked about in the show breeding populations. And I was telling Larry, I was at the Brewers game a week ago Monday, and we had a male mantid fly into the stands and sit on the person in front of me and sit on his shoulder. And so it's a real treat to watch this, and we would continue to expect the populations are basically from the Dell South, but we also have a remnant population in Door County that's been there for a few years. And so they're going to be more and more common. So that's one of the changing things going on out there.
And we have that pelicinid photo up too, which is a very cool looking.
Yeah, very critter. Unique, and again, very much adapted to go after the prey that they want. And scary looking, but as I said, nothing to worry about.
Nothing to worry about. Joe in Appleton has a question for you. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I was mowing my lawn, and I got bit by a large green grasshopper two different times, and I was just wondering, out of interest, what that's all about. I've never heard of being bit by one.
Well, you know, the green grasshopper is probably from a family we call the longhorn grasshoppers, because that includes the katydids and the bush crickets and the like. And they have chewing mouth parts, and they normally use that to chew on leaves and cut those up. And if they get the opportunity, I don't think of them normally as biting creatures, but there's an awful lot of things if handled or whatnot will. And so I think you were right. It gave a nip out of you, and it's probably just tasting you to see if you were its next meal. But as I said, it's not their nature to bite, but they do have the kind of jaws that will give you a pretty good pinch, might be the way to describe it.
Yes. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for calling. Bob in West Dallas, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Thank you for taking my call. I was cleaning out my mint yesterday, and I reached in, and I noticed that there was, I thought that they were honeybees flying around, but no, a friend told me those weren't honeybees, they were ground bees, and two or three of them stung me on the hand. And I'm just kind of wondering, well, what are these things, such thing as ground bees, and do they actually live in the ground?
Sure.
Or?
Well, there's two things. Honeybees never live in the ground. Their nature is to live in stumps and trees and hollows or the like. Bumblebees live in the ground, but those are fuzzy and, you know, black and kind of stout-bodied creatures. What people often refer to ground bees are basically paper wasp species that nest in old rodent burrows or other washed-out areas. They're black and yellow in color, and if you look at them very closely, they're not very fuzzy. Bees in general are very fuzzy. The other thing is honeybees are not black and yellow. They're really tan in various shades of lighter colors mixed in the body. So I would assume that it was one of the yellow jacket species. And, you know, they get grumpy when things are disturbed. So by pulling mint or whatnot, it may have just been enough of activity. And that's where you've got to be careful. Now, the good thing about ground bees, or as I said, what we would call paper wasp, is they will die out. They don't come back. It's not like honeybees. Honeybee is the only creature that we have here that lives as a colony, gets through the whole year, and sustains itself that way. On the other hand, if it's an area that's got a lot of activity, they'll be active for at least another 5 to 6 weeks. My recommendation is if you have to treat them, use a dust, not a spray. And you dust the entrance at about 7 o'clock at night. And there'll be some kind of hole, you know. And you can walk up to there closely and watch, just so don't make a lot of disturbance, where that hole is. That needs to be marked because that's what you need to treat.
There you go.
Very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Russ in Whitehall, on to you now. Hi, Russ.
Hi, Larry and Phil. And thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I think your previous caller maybe pretty much answered my question. I've had some, looked like an overgrown wasp, coming to the hummingbird feeder. Only the tail quarter inch on the bee is just a gorgeous yellow and black pattern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that what it is?
Well, you know, a lot of those wasps are sugar feeders. I mean, they're both protein feeders and sugar feeders.
Okay.
And yeah, we get a lot of problems. In fact, you know, when people ask about that, some of this has to do with hummingbird feeder design. Some of them are more prone to bee issues, some are not. And sometimes when they get to be problematic, they'll even keep the hummingbirds away.
Well,
as I said,
that was a question I sort of had. Will it keep a hummingbird from coming to the feeder if there's several bees around?
Yes. There are definitely times that they will be aggressive on that food source. And as I said, so if that gets to be a persistent problem, you may have to look. And again, if you get on the internet, there's a lot of people to discuss the proper designs that are less prone. Because basically, if the wasps can't get a sugar source, they're not going to hang around. But once they do know they have a sugar source, they keep coming back.
It was so pretty, I didn't really want to do anything.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. We got an email from, Ed in Burlington. Whenever I use a circular saw or a portable table saw in the backyard, several large flies land on the saw while it's in operation. My question is, are flies attracted to certain sounds?
Okay, I'm guessing at this one, but we know mosquitoes find each other by certain wing beat sounds, and there may just be that he's got a frequency that is used by that particular species of fly to find his mate. So that would be my guess. I mean, we definitely didn't know that exists without seeing the fly and whatnot. I couldn't be 100% sure, but as I said, as you know, when critters are buzzing around your ears, you do have things that have different frequencies, and insects do utilize that as a way of finding each other.
And Ernest posted on our Facebook page, this is a great year for butterflies and moths. Can you give the best book recommendation to identify them?
Well, and moths are more problematic because there's so many different species involved. There's an old field guide in the Peterson series called Moths of Eastern North America that if you can get a copy is pretty good. Butterflies, there's really a lot of good field guides that are there. But the other thing now with the internet, and there is a site on the butterflies of Wisconsin, and I can picture the gentleman. He's just an exquisite photographer. He has a site both on butterflies and robber flies and tiger beetles, and I can't remember his name. Butterflies of Wisconsin, and he has a number of pictures, and again, distribution maps, talks a little bit about when they're flying and the like. And so they said, I think there's a lot of those kind of guides too that you'll find useful. But in general, you know, you'll find good books for butterflies. We only have about 150 species, so that's a manageable number. But moth species, you know, we're up probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,500 or so, and I don't know one book that will get all the moths and the like. But as I said, the Peterson Field Guide series is pretty good, but there are definitely plenty of other good butterfly books out there.
And, you know, now these days with all the apps for iPhones.
Oh, I'm sure there's some apps for butterfly.
And that would be pretty handy because you always get your phone with you.
Right.
If you have one of those phones. And talking about moths and butterflies, Ryan said he's collected butterflies and moths most of his life, but never seen giant swallowtails in northern Wisconsin, but have now seen 5 so far this year in Barron County. And I'm wondering, have you got a population of those up there?
Well, you know, giant swallowtails, their host plant is prickly ash. And, of course, prickly ash is pretty common in our woodlots. But historically, they seem to be somewhat sensitive to our winters. I will tell you, I see a lot more giant swallowtails now than I did when I was a kid, and I equate that a lot to better overwintering survival. And they're, again, having a good year. I got an email this morning from somebody in Eau Claire that has similar comment that they and their family had collected butterflies forever, had never seen a giant swallowtail in Eau Claire, and they did. And so they're having a good year. They definitely are. And the question of breeding populations would be, again, if you've got prickly ash in the area, there's the potential. And then you put on top of that the lack of, 35 below and all this other craziness
sure.
that a lot of us put up with when we were younger. And I think that is allowing them to extend their range and have a good year.
Diane in Madison, we turn to you now. Hi, Diane.
Hi there. Phil, I've been waiting for your return to ask a question about fireflies.
Mm-hmm.
I came upon this little phenomenon on a little beach in North Madison, Warner Beach. It was after dark, and it was, I think, one of those days that was the hottest day of the year. And all these fireflies were in the sand. They looked like little Christmas lights lining the beach, and they had their blinkers up. But they were just on. So they were just all in the sand with their lights on.
Hmm.
And I sifted one out, and it felt warm, and it felt kind of heavy. And I didn't know if they were in there to die or if they were mating or just
when
getting away
die.
From
well,
the
you know, typically what's supposed to happen is the females stay stationary, and the males are the ones that are flying and flashing and advertising, and they kind of call mm-hmm. back and forth to find each other. With that phenomena, I don't know
if... And their lights were just on. They weren't blinking.
Yeah. That's not, so in that case, it's not as if they're looking for love as much as, I wonder if things were dry enough, they were desiccated enough that they were just going after water in feeding on the wet water that might be on the sand and the like. But typically, their pattern is to flash, not to stay on.
Mm-hmm.
And especially because the way that chemical reaction is, it's hard to keep it going, that's interesting. Yeah, I don't think I've ever quite seen that. They talk about the synchronized flashing of some species of fireflies, like in Thailand and the like. So there's some pretty interesting phenomena. But for them all staying on at one time, I'm not so sure I understand that one.
Huh. Would they have been affected by the heat? And trying to stay cool.
Well, no, yeah, that could be too. I mean, insects, when you start getting much above 100 degrees, they don't have the mechanism to cool their bodies. So they either have to find a cooler environment or find some way to dissipate the heat. So that may be the phenomenon. But, to congregate is one thing, but to congregate and still keep the light on is what fascinates me.
Hmm.
I have to ask my colleague, Dr. Young, who's our beetle person. I'll ask Dr. Young, and if we have an explanation, I'll email over to Larry and Judith, and we can put it up.
Yep, we'll put it up on the Facebook page. All right, thanks, Diane.
Great.
Appreciate your call. And here's an email from Pam from Pound. We've seen a bug that flies in and out of a flower like a hummingbird, about an inch long and a 2-inch wingspan, and it has antenna. While at a flower, it has a black beak or extension that they draw out of the nectar. Looks like a bee.
Mm-hmm. So the family is the hawk or sphinx moths, but there's a particular two species that we have here. This one's called the hummingbird clearwing, would be my guess. It is a bee mimic. And as the name implies, what's somewhat unique is that there's big patches in the wing that does not have any markings on it. You can see right through it. That's not typical of moths. Moths should have scales all over their wings. And they're having a pretty good year. I've probably seen 5 or 6 images that people have taken in their gardens of this species. The host plant of the caterpillar is honeysuckle. We've got plenty of that around. So as I said, do a search on hummingbird clearwing moth, and I'm sure you'll find the critter.
Philip in Brule Township. On to you now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, thank you, Phil, for the work you do, and especially your quick responses on emails. We appreciate that. I'm asking a question about the Colorado potato beetle. We live up here in the woods, and there are no other potato fields anywhere near, and not even very many other gardeners very nearby. And we have two potato patches that are about 100 and 125 feet apart. And we have gotten Colorado potato beetles into one of those and not the other one. And we're just curious as to how they get here. Why would they be up here when there's no other, food source?
There is. The trick is that there are some weed species that are solanaceous. So things like nightshade can support them. They don't thrive on nightshade, but they can limp along with it. And it sounds like they have found your one patch and not the other, which mm-hmm. is rather common. But once you get them in an area, they don't seem to go away. and it may just be a matter of time before the adults find the other potatoes if they're constantly there. And but as I said, you know, what is somewhat interesting is that we do have some native weed species that are closely enough related to potatoes. They will also feed on tomatoes. They will also feed on eggplant. But their least favorite is tomatoes. I don't see a lot of damage on tomatoes, whereas eggplant, they really do thrive on. And as they said, I bet you it's the weed host that is the reason they found you.
Okay, so they just migrate because of all of these weeds?
They're scattered around. You know what, the unique phenomena that I've never heard a good explanation, when I was a graduate student, Colorado potato beetles were extremely few and far between in the state. Mm-hmm. You know, so much so that if you told me to catch one, I'm not so sure I could have. And of course, they have just exploded in the last 30 years plus in stuff. And so they have expanded the range. A lot of that had to do with pesticide resistance, but it really is bigger than that, I think. And as I said, my experience is that once they get in an area, you know, people talk about, yeah, when my dad was a kid, he used to pick them, but they were gone. But now they pretty much spread throughout any place where we find potatoes, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh. There you go. Thank you very much, Phil, for calling. Appreciate it. Rob in Winnebago says, some unseen critter is burrowing into my tiny Thai peppers, eating the insides, leaving only a shell. Didn't get a look at them, but...
European corn borer will feed on peppers. There is a pepper weevil, although I don't see much of that. And I could probably come up with a couple other creatures, but the corn borer would be the first one I'd be suspicious of. Usually you see a little almost cigarette burn like hole on the outside. They go in and devastate things, and eventually the critter will move on and, you know, transform into the moth. So that would be my first guess.
And Carl in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Carl.
Howdy, Phil and Larry. Your discussion of fireflies gives me hope. I think I'm going to go out and buy a bunch of flashing lights, and I too will find love. I'm curious about something. For a couple of weeks now, critters, insects, bugs, whatever, that have a queen, when the colony is at its end, my understanding is that it's common for the progeny to swarm or whatever, and reproduce, and I'm wondering, because of inbreeding, why isn't the genetic diversity restricted so much that they don't just die out entirely?
Well, it depends on the critters. You know, a lot of things like ants, especially like carpenter ants, when their queen dies, the colony's dead. You know, there's no way that they... In fact, really the only species I know that is very adept at requeening are honeybees. They've got the system worked out, and of course, they make new queens, and they go flying off, and they keep one queen and the like. You know, the whole idea, though, with most critters that have this kind of strategy is that when the new queens come out, the virgin queens, they disperse. They're supposed to go and find males from other colonies, so you do get the genetic mixing that you would think would be beneficial. But again, it just depends on the kind of creatures. Usually, the ones that are very long-lived queens, like carpenter ants and termites, that can live for years, don't have the easiest way of, although termites have a mechanism, but ants in particular, not so much with replacing the queen. That's why she's lived so long and she's so important. But for other species, you know, things like our bumblebees and whatnot, they produce the queens in the fall. They produce males for the first time. And the fascinating thing about many of these species is that the difference between males and females is fertilizing and not fertilizing eggs.
Huh.
And so the queen literally both selects the sex of her offspring. They only make males in the late summer because that's the only time they're needed. They go through this dispersal, find a mate somewhere else. And what many insects will do then is store the sperm from that initial mating, some cases for years, which is really quite fascinating. And then she can utilize this. Now, in the case of honeybees, what's interesting is that unlike many insects that only mate once, they will mate multiple times in a very short period of time. So she basically has the sperm stored from numbers of males, which, again, would tend to promote genetic diversity. So it's really a very unique system.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for calling, Carl. Appreciate your call. And listener and Kathy in Lodi just sent us this wonderful photo of a clear-winged hummingbird moth that showed up in July.
Yes. Oh, it's a neat critter. In fact, again, I remember as a kid, that was probably one of the trophies that I had in my insect collection because it just such a odd-looking creature. You'd swear it had to be a bee. It's got those little tufts of hairs on the back end that make it look like it has an interesting tail. And as I said, it's been a good year for them, too, because I've seen more pictures of this than I would in a normal year.
And if you're listening in and want to take a look at that, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. It's a great photo. And Gary in Janesville, it's your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
Good. I've got a question. I've got some, up north, I've got some pine logs that I've cut up. And I noticed that the strange clicking sound coming from the logs.
Mm-hmm.
And they leave like a... insects in there, look like tiny holes, but the shavings are look like miniature toothpicks.
Yeah, well, there's a big insect that you get in either dead and dying trees or if you cut logs and let them sit in the summer. It's called the pine sawyer, S-A-W-Y-E-R beetle. It's technically a cerambycid or a longhorn wood borer, and the insect can take as long as 2 years to go through its life cycle. When the insect comes out, it will leave a hole at least as big as a pencil in diameter. It's a substantial insect. It makes a heck of a lot of noise. It kicks out a heck of a lot of sawdust. But the thing about it is that it can't get back in the wood because by the time it emerges, the wood has lost moisture. It's nothing serious, but I get a lot of people who are utilizing logs to build cabins and aren't careful. They become infested, and then, of course, they build a cabin, and for about a year or two, they have to put up with these creatures. But as I said, they run their course. They're not a structural issue, but it sure sounds like a pine sawyer to me.
There you go. Thank you for calling. And Karen and Nasita, hello to you.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We had an insect in the driveway and one on our bedroom deck. Never seen it before in my life. I'm wondering if it could possibly have been a cicada. It was about an inch and a quarter at least long. It was winged. It was dark grayish, and it had eye spots on its back.
Okay, the eye spots are a bit of a throw. I mean, cicadas remind me they're about as big as your thumb in the body.
Yeah.
They have very googly eyes, almost frog-like eyes. But no eye spots in any of the species that I'm aware of in the United States, and so.
Oh. I'm buffaloed then. I just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, you know, when I think of eye spots, they're much more common in. One to look at. Look under eyed click beetle.
Okay.
We have a creature called an eyed click beetle that is associated. The grubs are found in rotting wood, and the adult is this very interesting thing that. Has these big eye spots that's all they are. They're coloring. They're not anything else to them. And so that would be the insect in that size range that I would expect would have eye spots in the state.
Okay. Thank you for that. Thank
all right. Yeah. And thank you very much for calling. Quick email from Gary in Milwaukee. Broccoli plants, some green caterpillars. I think it turned into a white moths. Dining on his small broccoli plants.
Okay, imported cabbage worm is that little white butterfly guaranteed to attack your late summer broccoli and cabbage. There's an organic product called spinosad, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. One of the names it's sold under is Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew that will just be devastating to those little guys. You know, a lot of times you can grow your broccoli in the spring and get your summer crop out without a problem, but your late summer and fall crop, it's guaranteed to have worm pressure and it should be treated.
And with that... we're out of time. I don't know how many questions you answered today, Phil, but that was a lot between the Facebook and the email and the telephones. And you'll be back.
About a month.
About a month. We'll do this all over again. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison campus. He'll be back in about a month. Tomorrow at 11, we'll talk with financial advisor Frank Armstrong about strategies for retirement planning and for saving. And then at 11:45, we'll hear about what it was like to work with Sesame Street on their financial literacy project for kids and how we can help little ones understand money and saving. Stay with us.